5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I wanted to tackle some of your questions because there have been some quite good questions piling up underneath the videos. So I thought to myself, who do I know who can talk about that? Well, it's me. Anyway, so we've also got this lovely format thing that they've developed for the Lotus Eaters Daily. And I thought, well, yes, I can use that in order to have some questions and go through them and hopefully say something rather useful. So, here we go. Brokenomics series, you know and love it very well. Let's go into, that was a solo episode, Infinite Money Glitch. I seem to remember there's some good questions in there. So let's have a look. Oh, actually, before I start on the questions for that video, earlier today on the podcast, our good chap Alex asked me a question. Actually, let's see if we can get the editors to insert it here.
This question is for Dan. I'm a fairly risk-averse guy, and I like to see steady growth over a long number of years. And I'm eyeing the SPY ETF trust for the S&P 500 index fund. Is there any downside to investing in something like this? Now, I know you're not going to give me financial advice. Wink, wink. Okay, no need for the disclaimer. I appreciate your help, but it's had a 25% year-over-year increase the last 4 years. Seems like a safe bet. Is there something I'm missing? Thank you very much.
So Alex is asking about the SPY ETF trust. Now, so SPY is the Standard & Poor's index, presumably what the SP stands for. I don't know what the Y stands for. And it is basically a broad index of the 500 fund, 500 companies and the S&P index. Now, it's really difficult to give personalized advice because I don't know your circumstances. The bit that is relevant in this situation is the S&P, the SPY has fairly low volatility and reasonably decent returns. And that might be just the trick for you. Personally, I embrace the volatility because I don't mind more volatile assets, which can go down as well as up, as long as the net result of the up is much higher than the net result of the down. However, you may be saving for, I don't know, a house deposit or something like that, where large amounts of short-term volatility is very unhelpful because ultimately you are looking to deploy that money on something else for some practical purpose. In my case, I don't really care if there's a period of 2 or 3 years even of downward volatility, as long as I then get, you know, several years of very good up volatility. My other issue with passive funds, so index trackers, all that kind of stuff, is that there was an awful lot of dumb money on trackers. By that, I mean most of the money invested today is actually going into index tracking, which means there is nobody, well, it's not nobody, but there are far fewer individuals who are making intelligent choices about where the value really is, because so much money is just flowing into these indexes and they get a bid all the time anyway. Quick side note, that's one of the things that makes me a bit bullish about Bitcoin as well, because at the moment there is, well, basically all working age Americans and lots of other people from various other places as well, they get this constant drip that I think they call it their 401k, where they dedicate money every month. And most of that money then goes into the stock market and into trackers. So there's this perpetual bid for stocks, US stocks, from US investors, but also a lot of other people invest in US markets as well. So there's a constant upwards pressure on stuff. You can't put Bitcoin in your 401k, I believe. So there is no constant bid push coming from that. But that could change soon if something like MicroStrategy is included in one of the big indexes. And it might be, in fact, it might have happened by the time you watch this video, because it's the coming Friday that they add in or not. And that could then start adding a push effect that is currently absent from it. So yes, returning back to SPY, Alex talks about the 25% return level that you're getting on it. Okay, that's reasonably decent, actually. You've got to bear in mind that money itself, the US dollar, is being debased by about 14% a year. So if you're not earning 14% a year, you are going underwater. So if, let's say, it is 25%, you know, you're getting that extra, you know, 11%, so fine. Sounds reasonable. Don't particularly have a problem with it. It's got that low volatility, so if you do want to deploy that money at shorter notice, then by all means. It's just not for me, because I will take the time to do my own research on things and find where the specific opportunities are. I'm also willing to tolerate higher degrees of volatility and risk, and therefore I can get higher returns. But no, I don't think it's fundamentally unreasonable, other than the points that I made about indexes being, you know, not, they're not smart money. You know, they just track whatever's in the index, and they buy or sell, you know, depending on whether they go up or down within the index. So they maintain the proportion of the index. So don't have a problem with it. And it might well work for you. I would say that the best performing assets, when you divide them by the supply of dollars, and you can do that by taking the Federal Reserve balance sheet, because that's a close enough proxy for the supply of dollars. When you divide all assets by that, the two things that stand out is crypto and high-performing tech stocks, which I've talked about on a number of occasions. And the best proxy for that is probably the NASDAQ 100 rather than the S&P. But, you know, it, like I say, fine. It's fine. Fine. So, right, next question. Okay, so Return of McGuire says, while it might be a little bit boring, the basics of stock trading would be great. Standard lingo, when to sell, etc. Okay, so when to sell is not a basic of trading. That's the whole game, really. Well, I suppose along with buying at the right point, but there's lots of people who can buy at the right point. Selling at the right point is what really sets people apart. But yeah, the basics of trading, yes. So quite often, actually, I see something either on Twitter or in a comment or something which I have internalized to the point that I don't even think about it anymore, and people question the basics of something. So I've long thought that I want to cover the more basic levels of this stuff. But the problem is, because I've internalized so much of it for so long, it's not obvious to me where to start on that. So if somebody wanted to put down some questions to get me started, or I could figure out a way to do it, maybe I need to interview somebody who knows nothing or something. I don't know. But yeah, so I'm open for doing that video. It's just a question of how I do it and how I figure out what it is that the right questions that I answer. Okay, Alfred the Mid says, Dan, can you please cover profit taking in the next episode? I didn't make as much as I should from the GameStop saga, and I don't want to repeat the same mistakes with MSTR, MicroStrategy, and Bitcoin if I sell. Yes, so I have been thinking about how to profit take. And my thought process goes at this. Maybe I'll come back to it with another episode in more detail. But where I've got to in my thought process is, as you know, I'm not really... Okay, let me take you back. The Warren Buffett school of investing is you read for a company's accounts, you look at the profits they're making and their growth rate and their assets and so on. And from that, you work out what you think the company should be worth. You can, you know, say, okay, well, it's earning this much at the moment. You could stop there. You could just, you just take that current earning levels, or you can get a little bit more sophisticated and you can project those earning levels out 20 years in the future, and then and adding whatever growth rate you want to add. And then you can discount that by whatever cost of capital you want to apply to it back to today. And that will give you a value, what you think that company should be worth. And the whole Warren Buffett school of investing is you keep that number in mind as what you think it's worth. And when it drops low enough below it, you buy the stock. And when it goes high enough above it, you sell the stock. Okay, nice and simple. That's not really what I'm doing. That is what I used to do. In fact, that was a part of VC investing that I did for a long time as well. The figuring out your exit is one of the most important parts of it. In fact, before you even buy anything, you include in your investment note what you think the exit should be, who do you think you might sell it for, what kind of multiples you would do. So you know, thinking about that exit is a whole thing. But traditionally method, what I had done in the past and the whole Warren Buffett school, the value investing methodology, is all about when it hits a certain price, you know, that's the point to sell. However, that is not what I'm doing at the moment. What I'm doing is my macro thesis is all based around the fact that we have fallen into these four or five year cycles. That are based around the fact that, however we got here, and we talked about that in the past, growth of fiat money, debt, demographics, all that kind of stuff, we have got to a point where there is a structural deficit baked into Western economies. You know, the US is running a $2 trillion deficit during peacetime. It should not be running a deficit anything like that. It's not in a major war, but it's running a $2 trillion deficit every year. So that creates this massive demand for sovereign level debt, which needs to be rolled over. And we've got to the point now where you can't just have interest rates going down forever, because basically they hit zero and it broke stuff in recent years. You know, we've got off that zero bound. But still, you've got to run a liquidity cycle where every 4 years you get to roll over the debt, otherwise the whole game comes to a stop, which then mandates a need to have these liquidity cycles. And when things pump, they drive up risk assets. Risk assets are not being driven up for the sake of driving up risk assets. Liquidity is being pumped into this system in order to roll over government debts. So that is basically connected to this four-year cycle that I've talked about so many times on Brokenomics. So if my investment thesis is not based on picking a price and then determining whether I'm above or below that, my investment thesis is instead connected to the liquidity cycle, and I can determine that liquidity cycle is connected to, you know, basically a 4 or 5 year runway, then that means that my trigger to sell can't be price-based necessarily. I mean, I will look at a bit of that as well, and maybe we come into that a bit as well. But mainly, it has to be based on time, doesn't it? Because if I'm basing everything on a four-year cycle, well, okay, fine. So my sales have got to be linked to that four-year cycle as well. Now, the perfect way of doing this would be on the day of peak liquidity, then to draw down, to sell, and to build up my cash reserve. I don't think I'll ever get out entirely, but I'll build up my cash reserve, and then liquidity will fall. Assets which respond well to liquidity injections will drop disproportionately, and then I can buy up a greater share of it, and I can either, you know, spend the money or I can hold it for the next cycle and so on. But I'm not going to know when the day of peak liquidity is. It's the kind of thing you're going to only know in hindsight. But I can be reasonably sure that it will be the latter end of 2025 or perhaps early in 2026. That's what the liquidity indicators are telling us. Okay, so given that, I know that 2025 should be a very good year for liquidity. Assets that respond to that will do well. So it's just picking my points within that in order to take profits. Okay, so then I think, okay, well, because I'm not going to know when peak liquidity is, and actually there's probably a lot of investors thinking along the same lines as me, the best thing I can do is take profits based on time. And I'm thinking something like, I'll pick a day in spring and take a percentage, maybe, I don't know, for sake of argument, I'm still thinking this through. Sake of argument, in the spring, I'll take 10% off. In the summer, I'll take 15% off. In the autumn, I'll take, 20% off. And then in winter, I'll take 25% off. And if we're still running into spring of 2026, which is possible, well, maybe I'll take 30% off. You know, you get the idea. Because basically, the best returns are going to be backloaded. The closer to peak liquidity you are, the better the returns. And if I had to guess, I'd say, 26th of November 2025, you know, but that could be wildly wrong. I don't want to get left with nothing because I do want some goodies. So I'm definitely going to take something. And if I start in spring at a fairly low percentage, then I've definitely bagged some lifestyle chips that I can then go and spend on whatever it is that I want to spend on. And as I get later and later into the cycle, I increase the percentage that I'm taking off the top, in the full knowledge that, you know, let's say I were to take off 10% or 5% or whatever in spring, that I would then go, I could well go on to watch the cash value of that double over the course of the year. But there's not necessarily a better way of doing it, because it's better to get your profit taking in before liquidity peaks rather than after. And actually, I'm going to build out some profit taking models to try and understand this. But my suspicion is that actually, even though it looks like you're giving up a lot when you look at the individual sale, the effect on the portfolio as a whole is fairly small. That's what I'm starting to see so far. So I'm going to flesh out that idea, and maybe I'll come back with a Brokenomics that pins that down a bit. But that's broadly where I've got to so far. Investment criteria is based on liquidity. Liquidity is connected to time, and therefore exits need to be connected to time. It needs to be before peak liquidity, and therefore it needs to be a structured sale based on time going into that. So yes, I will think that through more, and I will come back with something. Right. Ross says, fantastic episode, Dan. I like Ross. He's apparently made some money on that. What is he saying here? Now, somebody who's young enough that the pension system will have exploded, how to go about building portfolio? If you could do, I ask that you explain how to go about achieving said task rather than assuming a Neanderthal swings hammers and navigates the financial advice landscape. Okay, so how to build a portfolio. Well, I mean, the way that I do it is to spend hundreds of hours poring over discussions between finance people, keeping an eye on what's hot on Twitter, the latest developments, thinking about future trends, and then narrowing down on what I feel that the opportunities are. What I'm really looking forward for is the big trends, the big cyclical trends. So I think, you know, a company like Tesla does that for me. It's getting behind the big adoption trends. Crypto is a big adoption trend. AI, if there was a good way to do it, I mean, if you're going to get into AI, I mean, you kind of led down the path of Google, probably, perhaps Microsoft, if you want to get into AI. I just don't like those companies because I don't like Bill Gates, and I don't like the fact that Google hates people like us because they're Californian Silicon Valley Uber libs. So that's the way I do it, which is probably not going to be helpful to most people because you're not going to have the hundreds of hours to put into it. So for the average person building a portfolio, the old thing always used to be 60-40, what was it? Was it 60% in bonds and 40% in stocks? I'm not a fan of that because bonds are debt notes for government who have no intention of paying them back and are actively trying to destroy the value of them because they can't afford them. Maybe 60-40 in Bitcoin and good stocks would be a better way. We talked further up in this episode about Alex and his SPY. So, yeah, I mean, I'll give that one more thought as well and come back perhaps with a video. But off the top of my head, you could do worse than maybe going a third into Bitcoin, even though we're getting close to the profit-taking bit rather than the accumulation bit. But over the long term, you know, if your investments are for 5 years plus, that won't matter. A third into good stocks, you can go for... What you can do is you can go for managed funds. They're quite good. If you find a good investment manager and then you get the diversification of multiple stocks and a manager who's quite sensible. So I'm not necessarily recommending them, but Fidelity, for example, are a big money manager. I mean, there's a whole bunch of asset managers out there. And if you're investing in a 401k or an ISA or something, there are plenty of brokers everywhere who can happily point you towards some of the better fund managers. And then a third, you could put it in property, something real, physical gold. That's one way of looking at it. You know, spread it out a bit. It's not the way that I do it, but thinking about what you want your broad allocation to be, whether it's stocks, gold, real estate, Bitcoin, whatever one of those you're comfortable with, spend a bit of time looking into it. Fine, that is perhaps a way to go. But yeah, I'll give it some thought. It's just so difficult giving financial advice to people because I don't know what your time scales are, your risk preferences are, what you need the money for, all that kind of stuff. Okay, first name, last name says, low energy Dan is my favorite Dan. You're a tiny bit less filtered, which is always better. Yeah, so this might be a reference to the fact that I sometimes have to record from home, especially when trying to get Americans, unless they want to get up really, really early to speak to me. And it has been noted I'm a little bit less energetic in the bunker rather than when I'm here surrounded by the chat. So there may be something to that. I'm certainly probably perhaps a bit more thoughtful in that because when I'm at home, I'm in the more thoughtful, well, that's when I'm scanning through a whole bunch of, you know, articles, videos, discussions, graphs, all that kind of stuff. And I tend to get a bit more introspective when I'm here, where I'm just booming at people. But yes, no, I will take that on board. Right. Right. Who do you recommend trading shares through, Dan? Well, I don't know where you are. If you're in the UK, I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. Best Invest, Hargreaves Lansdowne, Charles Schwab. I mean, I use Hargreaves Lansdowne myself because they're one of the biggest and it's just easy and they've got quite a good interface and you can do your SIP and your ICEs in there. But I mean, brokers, I mean, they're just much of a much, aren't they? So, you know, whatever you want to use. I mean, maybe you could even use that Robinhood thing. Never touched it myself, but, you know, brokers are brokers. Right. Daniel Lavery says, so you are not saying buy shares in MicroStrategy or not to buy the bonds they offer. Oh, right. Okay. So, well, with MicroStrategy, I mean, I buy just the common stock. The bonds have a really good risk return balance, but I'm not sure if you can access them as an individual. You might need to be an institution to be able to buy the bonds. So I'm not sure if you can. Maybe you can. But I'm not sure you necessarily have the option to buy the bond. The other thing actually to be aware of is there are some MicroStrategy trackers out there which try and amplify return. I think it's MSTU and MSTX. And I can't remember which way around it is, but one of them promises to give you 2x the return of MicroStrategy and one of them promises to give you 3x the return of MicroStrategy. So actually that is a good junction to talk about synthetic ETFs. By the way, 2x return, 3x return, that applies down as well as up. I think it's worth avoiding them. The reason is the way that they are achieving those returns is because they are buying options, short-dated options, in order to replicate the performance of the stock. Why is that problematic? It's problematic because even in an active options market, if you're doing this at volume, it can be difficult getting hold of the options you need to synthetically replicate the underlying asset. And so therefore, even though you're trying to achieve 2x or 3x, you might actually end up achieving something different because you just can't get the option supply. The other thing I would note about this, and this applies for any synthetic ETF that tries to give an amplification by doing it on options. It could be gold, silver. I mean, there's a whole bunch of funds out there that try and give you these amplified returns. When they're option-based, the thing that you need to be aware of is they only work when something is trading up strongly. So if you think, I mean, if you're thinking of buying a leveraged silver ETF or a MSTX, you only want to do it if you think that your underlying asset is going to pump imminently. You don't want to hold it in sideways markets. The reason you don't want to hold it in sideways markets is because one of the key elements of option pricing is the duration left on those options. And as time goes forward, you get time decay. You know, literally, you're getting closer to the event. And so therefore, the time value element of that option decreases. So if you hold any of these synthetic ETFs on a flat market, it won't stay flat. It will trade off, and it will trade off at the rate of option decay, time option decay on those underlying options. So I think it's just worth staying away from them, because actually you don't know when the pumps are going to be. Well, I don't anyway. I mean, maybe you could figure that out, and if you can, you know, have fun using them. But quite often you have to wait around in something which has high volatility for a while before it moves, before it breaks out of a band, whatever it is. So yes, I'm careful of that. So yes, in this particular case, I mean, personally, I just buy the underlying common stock because that is ultimately what the company is engineered to get the best returns on. But if you can find a way to buy the bonds, great. And like I say, avoid synthetic ETFs. Yes, please, on how to take a profits video, Dan. Yes, like I say, well, I've given you my thoughts on roughly what I'm thinking. And when I get that a little bit more polished, I'll come back with something. Right. John H. says, it seems like a lot of people now think that the value of Bitcoin will rise. That leads most people want to hold on to it. Therefore, Bitcoin, in my mind, will not circulate by ordinary currencies before the price of Bitcoin stabilizes, at least in relation to other commodities. How long do you think, how do you see this playing out? Okay, so, I mean, if people lock it down and hodl it, that just means that the value goes up in order to get other people to part with it at the margins. And so, therefore, more value can be transacted with a lower amount of coins. So that is an automatic balancing mechanism for it. It kind of doesn't matter if the price rising does not make it less attractive as a means of transaction. It makes it more attractive. More generally about the stabilization of the price. Okay, so this is going back to the fact that Bitcoin has high volatility at the moment. Now that the institutions are coming in, you know, the BlackRocks and so on are offering their ETFs, those ETFs are largely being bought by other institutions. Things like, you know, pension funds and what have you, insurance funds. When they make an investment, it's not like you or me deciding to do it as private individuals. The way that these guys make decisions is they have a researcher go and prepare a paper on it, you know, win over the chief investment officer, all that kind of stuff, you know, build support internally. He will go to their investment committee. Quite often, investment committee will only, if it's a small active VC fund, like I was involved in, the investment committee meets every week. But for something like an insurance fund or a pension fund, the investment committee might only meet once a quarter. They will do a presentation of that investment committee, it may be an initial report to say, look, we think this has promise. Here's a short one pager on it and an arguments for it. If the investment committee likes it, then they're basically saying, yes, you can take up much more of our time in the next meeting. The analyst will then circulate a much more in-depth paper. The investment committee guys will then read it, and that could be a much more detailed, I don't know, 20, 30-page report ahead of the next investment committee, and then they'll spend several hours debating it. It's not a simple process. But the upside of this is once they have decided on a allocation, then that is the allocation. And it will sit like that for years. So let's say they decide to assign Bitcoin 3% of the pension fund, or the insurance fund or whatever it is, it's now set at that level. And that provides automatic stabilization going forward. Why? Because if the price of Bitcoin goes up and it goes over 3%, say 3.1%, well, they sell the 0.1% because they've said the allocation is 3%. And likewise, if the price goes down and it goes to, say, 2.8%, well, they'll buy 0.2% in order to get it back to the allocation. So once the institutions arrive, they provide an automatic stabilization effect of selling Bitcoin when it goes too high and buying Bitcoin when it goes too low. That's the benefit of bringing institutions into this. So what should happen as Bitcoin goes up, its usefulness as a payment network improves and its volatility decreases in both directions. And that seems to be what's happening so far, but this is the first cycle where the institutions have really got on board. Buying Bitcoin is incredibly difficult directly for things like pension funds and insurance funds, because I mean, okay, you can go and buy the coins off the exchange, but then who's going to hold the private keys? And it's really awkward. But an ETF is like a sippy cup for them. You know, it's an easy way where they don't have to faff around with custody problems. They just buy a stock like they buy anything else, and they know how to do that. So yes, time of the institutions on this. Mario Cat says, can you do an episode on Hegelian economics? I have no idea what that is. Is that based on Friedrich Hegel, the ethics guy? So is that all about ethics of economics? I don't know. I will look into that. I don't think I'll do an episode on it unless I find it incredibly compelling. The ethics of economics. I'm assuming it's that Friedrich Hegel. Right. Mike on the Roof says, good video. I didn't realize how substantial this would be until after Hayes talked about it on a show, which would still be a good time to get in it under 200 pre-election discount. Keep up the content from the bunker, Daniel. Definitely doing better on the distant action stuff today. The audio sounds a little low bit rate with a few sloshy nods. Yeah, so this is why I joined the Lotus Eaters in the first place, is because I had a go at doing this stuff myself, and the button stuff is just an absolute bloody nightmare. In fact, a number of people have made the point about my mic at home that it clips at the top or that I need more gain on it. The problem is when I had the gain turned up, you very easily go past the top limit and it clips out. And then if you turn the gain down too low, people complain that you're you know, not coming across strong enough. So fiddling around with sound, it was an absolute nightmare. But yes, I suppose we learn on how we go. Yeah, Skyman says 1,000% on profits, on taking profits. Yeah, well, I hope my comments so far have been helpful, and I will continue to polish that and come back with something good. Callie, it was at Kale, well, whatever it is. You are or have bought MST or Bitcoin. Is there a big risk this cycle is over? Oh, right. Okay. Yes. Saying, well, if you're now at the point where you're doing this kind of stuff, you know, and, you know, if your mum's talking about it, if your taxi driver's talking about it, perhaps that indicates you're near the end of the cycle. Could be. I think almost certainly not, because what I'm actually looking at is the liquidity flows. The debt has not been rolled over by the big sovereigns. I mean, they're starting to do it, but there's a lot of debt that needs to be rolled over in 2025. I don't think that Western governments, and it's all of them, it's not just the US, I don't think Western governments want to roll over a massive amount of debt when interest rates are high and liquidity is still lower than is optimal for that. I think they are highly incentivized to massively increase liquidity over the course of 2025, bring interest rates lower, all that kind of stuff, in order to cycle over their debt. And the side effect is that I think the market has a lot further to go, specifically on Bitcoin. And this is not a price prediction. It's me just thinking through the logic of what I see in the charts. If you take the log regression of Bitcoin and you project it forward to the end of 2025, it gets you to quite a high price point. In fact, what is it? I've got it on my other... Bear with me a second while I call up my other screen, because I saved it as my background. Yeah, it takes you to something like 170,000 over the fullness of this cycle. And then you think, okay, that's the center line of the log regression. What if you get one standard deviation overbought? Or what if you get two standard deviations overbought? And bear in mind that it has never not got two standard deviations overbought. That takes it to sort of north of 350. And that feels really toppy right now. I'm just saying that's what the chart shows you. Typically, it does tend to surprise to the upside. Now, why is that? Why is it that you get this sort of blow off top effect when liquidity gets really good? You have to remember that when things are trading, it's not the entire underlying asset that trades at that higher price. It is a tiny fraction of the asset trades. So it's really the margin that level is thing. And when things start to get exuberant, those small number of shares or small number of coins get bid up, which nominally revalues the entire asset or blockchain or whatever it is. And it gives the impression that things have got incredibly toppy, but it was never really real. The real price action does not take place in that sort of late period of exuberance. It's price discovery over the long term. So the log regression is probably the right level. Bitcoin over this cycle to 170 seems entirely reasonable to me, but don't exclude the possibility that there is a period of a couple of months where it gets bid up very heavily above that. It's not impossible. In fact, if you go on past markets, it's actually even likely. Now, the last cycle was a somewhat stunted cycle because of, all the weird things that were happening last cycle back in 2020 and 2021. And so the last cycle never really played out as expected. A lot of people thought we were going to 100K then. It's perhaps possible that this cycle for Bitcoin plays out more like 2017, which would mean, 350,000 is in play, which sounds ridiculous now, but it is only the log regression plus two standard deviations, which when you base that on market behavior from past cycles is possible. I'm not saying that's a prediction, and if it does happen, it will be, like I say, it will be ethereal. It won't be real. It will be a blow off top, but nevertheless, there is that possibility to sell into that sort of blow off top type event, which then takes me back to my profit taking ideas that I talked about earlier, that you want to try and achieve the top, but you're not going to achieve the top. And that's why you want to sell in stages. But the very last bit is the bit which is truly spectacular. So yes, I'll give that all of that more thought and come back to that. But you can see how I'm thinking it through. Okay, so Dan's Jawline Jow Jiggler, interesting name, says up 10% in the day between the video releasing it and me seeing it. Sad face. Yes. So this again is one of the reasons I'm so reticent to sort of talk bullishly about things when we've entered the liquidity cycle. But I mean, I've spent the last 2 years saying that this period is coming, so I kind of need to follow it through. Bear in mind that I was doing most of my buying for the stuff that I like, well, 2 years ago. That's why I made so many videos about Bitcoin back at the time, and mentioned it then, and various other things that I liked. It is difficult for somebody like me, who has people who listen to him, because we've entered the phase where the volatility is going to be notable both up and down. And if you were to follow the things that I'm saying now, then you might well end up going the other way. For example, you might go down 10% the day after you buy it. And for you, that level of volatility may be something that you're completely uncomfortable with, and you'll freak out and you'll sell, and then you've just lost 10%. It's very difficult. I do believe that the kind of things that I talk about and like are going to be good over a 5-year cycle, even if you do buy at the top. You know, as if, you know, if you bought at the top of the last Bitcoin cycle, at whatever it was, 70 something, you know, you're already in profit now, but you did have to wait a period of years. So I don't think you're going to be worse off over the long term, but you might be underwater for a period of a couple of years if the cycle is shorter than I anticipate. But I suppose buying now is better than buying once the liquidity caps really come on. But yes, just bear in mind, you've got to see this series as a whole. The, you know, when I was jumping up and down about buying this stuff 18 months ago, that was really the time to get in. Not that I'm saying there isn't some upside left from here.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
Switching between different tools to finish a project can feel stressful and disjointed, especially while juggling tight deadlines in a fast-paced work environment. Now, there's a better way. Grammarly built a writing service that's a game changer for professionals. It helps move your ideas forward and sharpen your words for better results, all in one place. With Grammarly's AI agents, you get writing support at every step to bring polish and impact to your emails, reports, and proposals without the tab overload. Email sounds robotic, phrasing feels off, writing for a high-stakes client, Grammarly's got you covered. You can even ask Grammarly's AI chat to help brainstorm brilliant proposals, summarize meeting notes in seconds, or even shape a winning sales strategy, all right from your doc. 93% of professionals say that Grammarly helps them get more done. Now, it's your turn. Sign up for free and get stronger results. Faster work, smarter sentences, clearer finishes. Visit Grammarly.com to get started. That's Grammarly.com. Switching between tools for one project gets disjointed, especially on tight deadlines. Grammarly built a game-changing writing surface tailor-made for professionals to help you move ideas forward and sharpen your writing. You can brainstorm ideas, summarize meeting notes in seconds, or strengthen a proposal without context switching. Easy to get started and even easier to finish. Sign up for Grammarly free and get your professional writing from draft to done. Visit Grammarly.com. That's Grammarly.com.